What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fuelled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
Press TV spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified. Seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
The United Nations aid chief Martin Griffiths said the humanitarian operations in Yemen is about to start doing a lot less. In his latest briefing to the UN Security Council, he warned that the aid agencies are quickly running out of money, forcing them to slash life-saving programs. His remarks has sparked harsh reactions in Yemen.
The UN's decision to cut humanitarian aid threatens the lives of millions of Yemenis. The United Nations is subject to the conditions of donors, most of whom are from the countries of the Saudi-led coalition, and therefore they are politicizing humanitarian aid to achieve what they have failed militarily. The United Nations describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and Yemenis have been suffering since the beginning of the war, and the UN aid is already scarce.
Since January, the World Food Programme has reduced rations for 8 million of the 13 million Yemenis it feeds each month. Griffiths said rations may be cut further from March or even stopped, meaning that millions of Yemenis may die of hunger.
When we see the reality and what is happening on the ground and how the Yemeni army continues to achieve victories in various battlefronts, we realize that the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its declared goals, and therefore they are seeking to put pressure on the Yemeni army by reducing humanitarian aid to the country. Reports confirm the high rate of death among children, and this confirms the failure of the United Nations humanitarian operation in Yemen.
The reduction in food rations comes with millions of people in Yemen facing starvation as a result of the ongoing years-long Saudi war and the blockade imposed on the country.
As observers say, the United Nations may announce a death sentence for millions of Yemenis if gaps in its funding are not filled. They warn that if the world body wants to save more lives in Yemen, it must reduce the operational expenses of its agencies that deplete the humanitarian funding. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Despite a statement by Lebanon's Interior Minister Bassam Maulawi last week directing security forces to cancel any event critical of the Bahraini regime, prominent Bahraini opposition group Al-Wifaq held its scheduled event. The event, titled United for Justice, marked 11 years since Bahrain witnessed popular uprising demanding justice and political freedom.
As Bahraini opposition and Bahraini factions, we are working on unifying our stances. What unites us is more than what divides us. We're united in our cause, and our demands for justice and freedom are one.
Those who support the Bahraini opposition believe that the Bahraini people's struggle for freedom and any people's uprising for the sake of reform is similar to the Palestinian people's struggle for liberation from the Israeli occupation.
The struggle to face the forging of people's will and theft of their rights and resources, and the hijacking of political decision, as well as fighting for human rights in Bahrain, are similar to facing the Zionist enemy in Palestine and facing corruption and wrong in Lebanon and facing the conspiracy in Syria. This is one confrontation and one battle. The Bahraini normalization of ties and the visit of the Israeli Prime Minister prove what we have been calling for in the last 10 years.
The political representatives and Muslim clerics attending the event stress that as Lebanon has always been a place for freedom of speech, opposition members of any country, as well as the Bahraini opposition groups, should be allowed to come here and speak. In addition to a violent crackdown on peaceful protesters, the Bahraini regime has now taken the lead in its normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, thereby going against its people's main cause. Experts believe this issue could further energize the Bahraini opposition in its struggle to be heard. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalized several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over, and radicalize schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed and we witnessed this firsthand was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts, but this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized, I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Sadhika, a 12th grade student in New Delhi, is outraged. She says it could perhaps be the first time in Indian history a particular community is being targeted for what they wear. Earlier, it would be our mosques, what we eat, our marriages, our personal laws. Now it's what we wear.
Being an Indian, we are very proud to be here. And we feel like every human being has a right to decide. They have their own choice. We don't need to interfere between their choices. The Constitution also gives us right there like that.
Last week, a video circulating on social media became a sensation within a few hours. A young college student from the southern Indian state of Karnataka was heckled by a group of saffron-clad Hindu students chanting slogans hailing Hindu deity Rama. The girl responded back with a similar reaction, chanting Allah Akbar, which means God is great. The incident blazed the public sentiments, with many calling the girl lioness, while others hailed her an iron lady. As India's state elections are underway, experts say polarizing the voters is a common phenomenon in India, with religion being the easy tool.
All effort is to try to erase Muslims from public places and to prevent them from being seen in public and impose apartheid on Muslim women. They are trying to achieve that target, but it's not as easy as they are thinking.
Another college student who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the ruling BJP might rewrite the constitution, considering their policies and actions they are imposing in a country.
It's the personal choice of a person to wear whatever they want to do, and according to constitution, we have the rights. It's totally a sad thing, and it's really like particularly targeting a particular community due to which we start living in a threat.
Ban on Islamic hand scarves has outraged the Muslim community, saying it's an outright attack on their faith, which the constitution guarantees to safeguard. They say it could perhaps be an attempt to prevent Muslim women from attaining education or to flare communal tensions amid elections. Observers say anti-Muslim rhetoric has flared aggressively since BJP formed the government in 2014. They say since 2014, most of the elections in India were overly polarized. Religious divide has been the main trump card of the current administration. Based on rights groups, the ruling BJP has adopted various laws and policies that legitimize violence and targeting religious minorities. Experts say it's a larger political agenda to make India a supremacist Hindu nation. Meanwhile, protesting student groups have defended the use of hijab, saying the constitution guarantees them religious freedom. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
People from all walks of life held a rally Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, especially those held under administrative detention. The event is part of a week-long national campaign in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. This, as Palestinian prisoners observed a one-day hunger strike on Monday in all Israeli prisons.
We are here to send a message of solidarity to administrative detainees and to all the prisoners. We will not let the prisoners down, and we will spare no effort to release them. We also call on all international agencies to stop Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are denied basic rights. Last month alone, Israeli regime forces arrested 504 Palestinians, including 50 children.
We are here to call on Palestinian resistance factions to support the prisoners and exert pressure on the Zionist regime to release them. Our enemy doesn't want peace and only understands the language of force and the language of armed resistance.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world turns a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Administrative detainees are currently boycotting Israeli courts because their detention is illegal. They are being held under secret evidence under inhumane conditions. Administrative detention is an Israeli policy to make prisoners suffer.
Palestinian administrative detainees are being held without charge or trial, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Currently, the Israeli regime keeps more than 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention, including women and minors. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The meeting between Vladimir Putin and Olaf Scholz was the first since Scholz's appointment as the German chancellor. During the talks, Putin called Germany one of Russia's main partners. The leaders touched upon the issue of Russia's proposals for security guarantees. The Russian president stressed that Moscow cannot turn a blind eye to how freely the United States and NATO interpret the principles of the indivisibility of security, noting that the expansion of the North Atlantic Alliance to the East continues, despite the assurances of Western partners.
About the expansion of NATO, here you said a wonderful phrase. They say that Ukraine will not be in NATO in the coming years. What does they say mean? You and I must understand what is spoken in interstate relations. We have been told for 30 years that there will be no NATO expansion at all, not one inch towards the Russian borders. And today we see the NATO infrastructure right at our house.
Putin added the postponement of Ukraine's entry into the bloc will not change anything, and Moscow would like to resolve this issue now. Speaking about the escalation in Ukraine, the Russian leader called what is happening in the Donbas a genocide. On February 9th, Olaf Scholz noted that Germany is ready for dialogue with Russia at all levels and in all possible formats for the sake of a political settlement. At the same time, he stressed that Moscow should not underestimate the cohesion and determination of Germany's NATO allies.
As for the situation with the negotiations, the positions differ, but it's important that we talk to each other. The proposals that were formulated by Russia, we also do not agree with them. NATO and the EU do not agree, but they also contain points that we are ready to talk about and are ready to discuss. Now it is necessary that a dangerous situation does not arise.
The German chancellor noted that positions of the West and Russia on security guarantees diverge, but the issue of Ukraine's membership in NATO is not on the agenda. This is while statements that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine continue to come from the West, an allegation vehemently denied by Moscow.
Germany, as an important member of NATO, could influence its partners in the bloc, who, judging by their actions, are set up for a conflict with Russia. Moscow is not satisfied with semitones and ambiguities in matters of security guarantees. Their clear fixation is necessary. Only thanks to this it is possible to achieve a diffusion of tension, which is in the interests of Germany, located in the center of Europe. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
Another bloody day has been witnessed in the occupied West Bank, this time in Jenin. 17-year-old Palestinian teen Mohammed Abu Salah was killed in the village of Silat al-Harithiya as Israeli troops raided the town on Sunday night to demolish the home of Palestinian prisoner Mahmoud Jaradat. Dozens of Palestinians were injured by live ammunition and rubber bullets fired by the Israeli forces towards the protesters who rushed to the area to prevent the demolition. Mahmoud Jaradat is a prisoner accused of carrying out shooting last December that led to the killing of an Israeli settler near the illegal settlement of Homish.
What my dad did is a heroic act. It's a very sad and painful feeling to see our home destroyed, but we don't want to show the Israelis that we are sad. We can rebuild the home.
The Israeli forces raided the village and immediately opened fire at the protesters because youths gathered to protest the demolition. A number of them were wounded and one was killed while defending Jaradat's home and after a few hours, the Israeli soldiers blew up the house with dynamite.
Tension continues to remain high for the third consecutive day in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Clashes have been breaking out between Palestinian residents of the neighborhood and Israeli settlers and soldiers. Paramedics say over 30 Palestinians have been injured. A dozen others were also detained. The clashes came shortly after Israeli far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gavir announced that he would be setting up an office in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to protect the settlers. Ben-Gavir had erected a tent in the front yard of Salem family home, another family in Sheikh Jarrah facing imminent expulsion.
The Israeli extremist Knesset member is leading a campaign to allow settlers to take over Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israeli regime is giving him full support, while Palestinians are defending their presence in Sheikh Jarrah and resisting the Israeli project to wipe out their existence.
Several Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah face potential eviction by settler organizations, all following last year's tensions and the May war between the Israeli regime and armed groups in the Gaza Strip. Observers today warned that Israel's continued aggression against Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and its escalating violence across the occupied territories could be the spark that sets the entire region ablaze. Because at the end of the day, Palestinians say they will remain steadfast and Tel Aviv's violence will not stop them from defending their rights. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
In the limelight.
This money belongs to the people of Afghanistan, not to the United States, said an Afghan protest organizer in Kabul recently. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by John Curley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Love to Afghanistan Vigils to Demand Return of $7 Billion Stolen by U.S. Here's the details. With the people of Afghanistan facing one of the most severe humanitarian crises in the world, U.S.-based peace activists who largely blame the policies of their own government for inflicting pain on millions of innocent Afghans are demanding the Biden administration to return billions of dollars of seized assets to the war-torn country before more lasting harm and cruelty is done. Under the banner of Love to Afghanistan, nationwide actions were scheduled for the weekend and localized vigils organized set for other days by Peace Action, World Beyond War, and other humanitarian groups who argue that $7 billion frozen by the U.S. government and subsequently seized by an executive order issued recently by Joe Biden rightfully belongs to the Afghan people, who without it face an economy on the brink of collapse and a healthcare system and federal infrastructure without adequate support amid the COVID-19 pandemic and a worsening food crisis. Thus far, the vigils took place in Illinois, Kentucky, Maine, New York, and other states. According to a call to action by organizers, after 20 years of war in Afghanistan, Peace Action welcomed the withdrawal of troops from the country and an end to the war. Yet, when the United States military pulled out of Afghanistan, the Biden administration also responded by choking off assets to Afghan banks and the economy by freezing the reserves of the Afghan Central Bank held in the U.S. They also imposed sanctions on those doing business with Afghanistan and cut aid. Jobs and income disappeared, people cannot afford to buy food, and mass starvation is now occurring. Hi. Hunger could kill more now than in two decades of war. This humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan is, in the words of the International Red Cross, a human-made catastrophe. Human-made largely by coercive U.S. economic policies. In December, 46 members of Congress wrote a letter demanding the U.S. unfreeze assets that had been locked following the U.S. military withdrawal earlier in 2021. But instead of heeding that call, Biden took the step of more permanently seizing the funds that otherwise would be under control of Afghanistan's central bank. The Bank of Afghanistan, that is DAB, which now operates under the authority of the Taliban government. Biden's executive order includes setting aside half of the funds, $3.5 billion, for possible settlement claims by families who lost loved ones in 9/11 attacks of 2001. But critics have said the Afghan people who had nothing to do with the crimes of that day 20 years ago should not be punished for the acts of Al-Qaeda, most of them Saudis and Egyptians. Promoting the Love to Afghanistan events in the op-ed for Common Dreams last week, peace activist John Etty, coordinator of the Montgomery County Peace Action Group in Maryland, said the economic war against the Afghan people has the potential to be just as deadly as the 20 years of war and occupation they have just endured. Explaining the current situation and the liquidity crisis gripping the country, she wrote, "The government has almost no money and cannot pay workers who cannot buy food for their families. Most have received no payment for months. In addition, Afghans have limited access to their own funds in banks. International commerce has halted." Given U.S. sanctions and the liquidity crisis, even international humanitarian relief organizations have great difficulty operating in Afghanistan, despite U.S. government assurances. Relief efforts designed to stave off starvation, although critically important right now, cannot endure for long since no one is willing to provide assistance indefinitely to a country of almost 40 million people. The country needs a functioning government and economy and needs access to the international financial system. Political backbone is now required of the Biden administration, argued Etty, who said the president should not be scared of predictable GOP attacks or media hit pieces about somehow appeasing the Taliban by giving the everyday people back money, the money that rightfully belongs to them. The lives of 1 million children are more important than a negative headline in a tabloid. The U.S. should unfreeze Afghan government assets and lift sanctions hindering the recovery of the Afghan economy and humanitarian relief efforts. We must end the U.S. economic war on Afghanistan. Recently, the Da Bank of Afghanistan demanded the funds ostensibly stolen by the U.S. government be returned and called the move by Biden an injustice against the people of Afghanistan. Also, recently, protests in Kabul decried the theft of the money. "This money belongs to the people of Afghanistan, not to the United States. This is the right of Afghans," Abdulrahman, a civil society activist and the demonstration's organizer, told the Da newspaper. Spokesperson for the Taliban government, Mohammad Naim, also decried the move in a post on social media, saying the theft and seizure of money held by the United States of the Afghan people represents the lowest level of human and moral decay of a country and a nation. Naim tweeted, added that, "While victory and defeat are evident throughout history, the greatest and most shameful defeat is when moral defeat combines with military defeat."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The recent revelations about the Trojan Horse scandal, a hoax plan for so-called extremists to take over a number of British schools, highlight the issue of institutionalized Islamophobia in the UK, and how victims of the government-backed Islamophobic purge are calling for justice and a fresh, independent inquiry. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll look at the different aspects of this scandal, as well as the role and goals of the British government in promoting Islamophobia.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fueled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
Press TV spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined, and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified. Seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan Horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
Joining us on Spotlight, we have Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedburgh, and Head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajarib, who's joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom.
bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start with Yvonne Ridley in Jedbro. Ms. Ridley, it's great to have you with us. It's been years since we last spoke. So demands for an independent inquiry into Britain's Trojan horse scandal have grown after this podcast recently highlighted several unanswered questions from the entire saga. So after so many years, why are there still so many unanswered questions?
Well, because as we've already heard in that excellent report by Robert Carter, that the whole Trojan horse affair was one big hoax. But it didn't stop the government and ministers like Michael Gove acting as though this was a very real threat. And as a result, decisions taken affected all of the state-funded education in England and Wales. And there was a McCarthy-style witch hunt. But instead of people looking for reds under the bed, they were seeing Muslim extremists where there were none. Like all injustices, the Trojan horse affair cast a long shadow over Muslim communities. And the real losers were people like the one that we just heard, whose lives and careers were ruined by the Trojan horse affair. But also the long-term losers have been Muslim children in those schools, not just in Birmingham. This is right across England. I spoke to somebody today who was a school governor in Bradford, who was edged out because people were seeing extremists everywhere where there were actually none. This whole affair has damaged people's lives, damaged careers, damaged the education in England and Wales. It's been very destructive. It's cast a very long shadow, and the government must be held to account. Good that the Muslim Council of Britain is calling for justice, but also ordinary members of the public have taken it upon themselves to sign a petition and try and force the issue to be debated in the House of Commons.
Masu Chajere, in 2017, the cases against the teachers collapsed, but their defense has never been heard to this day. Who should be responsible for this? Who should compensate, basically, the individuals that bore the brunt of this fabricated scenario? Despite numerous government reports, parliamentary hearings, and an array of legal processes, why has the truth been so hard to pin down?
Well, what was being accused was that the Muslim community or certain members of Muslim community are coordinating, organizing, to take over the education and divert and brainwash the children, not just Muslim children, but children. But the reality was that the only people who were getting together to converse and create a coordinated effort to do damage and do unlawful things was Mr. Gove and his colleagues. You know, he brought Peter Clark, which was the ex-head of the anti-terrorism of Metropolitan Police, with no expertise in trying to actually unleash whatever was happening or what was being accused within the schools. But his expertise was to always see a Muslim wrongdoers around the corner. And this is why he was brought in. I mean, it is very important to remind the viewers that what happened prior to this was these schools which were turned around. They were failing the schools. They were turned around by this team of dedicated Muslims, not just for the Muslim children, but for everyone. So here was actually a solution to the problems of education in inner cities, which the Muslims rose up and start addressing. And actually, they were commanded for this. And then because of a fraud, someone took a position of writing a false letter, and everyone, Gove as a minister and indeed everybody else in authority, jumped on that bandwagon and demonized the whole of the Muslim community, disassociated Muslims for being involved in the future of the children, their children, and indeed other children. And that sort of process of helping the education within inner city, turning failing schools into actually a proper school, was totally lost to the Muslim children and indeed everybody else. And I would say that on top of the fact that we have to blame the institutionalized Islamophobia, which is definitely behind this, we also have to blame the Muslim community and Muslim community institutions, because they failed to rise up and help and support not just these teachers, but stop the demonization of whole of the Muslim community. Their failure at the time, it really is very worrying. When you compare the currently Sikh council sort of on the immigration bill, turning around to all the members of parliament and saying that anyone who's voted for this racist bill will be welcome to go into any of the temples, the Muslim councils actually failed miserably to support and indeed stand up against this institutional Islamophobia.
Ms. Ridley, you were nodding there when we were listening to Mr. Shajada. How do you perceive the role of the government in this scandal? And more importantly, what was the end result of it?
Well, I agreed with most of what Masood said, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community. The Muslims in Britain, ever since 9/11, have been put under the cosh. There's been paranoia displayed towards Muslims. Islamophobia has been fueled, and this race hate has really been directed at the Muslim community. Muslims back in that period, about a decade after 9/11, they felt under fire and had lost a lot of the confidence that they used to have. So when there was this deluge of criticism directed towards the schools about these Muslim fundamentalists creeping into the education system and trying to push extremist views onto the children, they just believed it. And of course, it was one big lie pushed conveniently by Michael Gove, who was one of the most Islamophobic ministers in this government, a government which has a reputation these days for pushing out lies on an almost daily basis. But what is also important in this, while Michael Gove was pushing this, he also used this fake letter as an excuse to roll out some extreme counter-terrorism measures, such as the notorious, now discredited, Prevent strategy in schools, which turned every teacher, every teaching assistant, even parents into spies, which again undermined the confidence of the community.
Indeed.
Children were, any children that showed, say, support for Palestine were reported to the Prevent scheme. Millions of pounds was poured into this discredited scheme while the education budgets were creaking along and you know, not able to perform. So there was a lot of there was a big domino effect in this, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community as a whole.
Okay, Mr. Shajara, you can also respond to that. That's exactly where I was going next. As a result of the government responded by implementing the so-called anti-terrorism prevent strategy in schools, it also made it a requirement for all schools to promote fundamental British values. Is religious intolerance being promoted in Britain?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we know that this government, and indeed the rest of Europe, the governments, and we are seeing sort of similar thing happening in France, Germany, and elsewhere. There is institutional Islamophobia, and the demonization of Muslim has become the norm, and we are in this environment of hate against Muslims. The problem is this, that, you know, there is amnesia within those who are head of the so-called leadership of the Muslim community. And every time any incident happens, there seems to be somebody comes and push a button of reset button, and we forget about everything that has happened in past, and we're forgetting that we are living in this environment, and then we get letters from the Muslim Council of writing to MPs and thanking them. I don't know for what, for the fact that they're not addressing the ever-increasing Islamophobia. We need to be extremely critical of this Islamophobic government, which is actually more Islamophobic than previous one, and there's no doubt about that. But at the same time, we need to actually be internally criticizing ourselves, because our institutions are not fit for purpose. They still want to rub shoulder, and they think that they get influence by having a cup of tea or rubbing shoulders with a minister and two. And I think, you know, Yvonne knows this very well. I remember, Yvonne, you raised that once in a meeting we were to one of the very senior police officers. You know this, I know this, and unless we tackle this, unless we actually stand up with the situation is as bad as it is now, we need to be fit for that purpose. And that means we need to stand up not just for protecting the Muslim community, which needs to be protected, but the whole community, because this environment of hate is so poisonous that actually affects everyone, Muslims and non-Muslims. See what happened in former Yugoslavia. See what has happened previously in other structures when these level of demonization have been unchecked.
Ms. Ridley, the effects of such affairs, such sagas, they are all-encompassing. 8 years on, this Trojan horse affair remains perhaps the best-known and most polarizing story about Britain's relationship with its Muslim citizens. What have the British public, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, learned from all of this?
Well, sadly, I would think that the majority of the British public outside of the Muslim community are not aware of this excellent Trojan Horse podcast, which has been produced by the New York Times. Why is it that this excellent piece of investigative journalism and great expose has come from America? Because it should have come from the British media, but unfortunately, the British media is also institutionally racist and Islamophobic, and you know, this is where we have a problem. And what I would like to see the Muslim community do, not necessarily through the leadership of the MCB or any of these other Muslim organizations, is start to stand up. As I've often said, if you get up off your knees and stand up, the so-called great don't seem that great from that position. And so the Muslim community needs to get its confidence back. Maybe we should take a lead from the black communities in Brixton and in Toxteth. They got a lot of justice back through riots. I'm not suggesting Muslims rise up and take to the streets. We have other mechanisms and other ways of making our points known. But maybe we should take a zero tolerance lead from the black community and be vocal and be robust and demand our rights. You know, human rights are for everyone in Britain, not just a few. And so this is something that we need to get a confidence back in the Muslim sure. community. That's what we need.
Mr. Shajadeh, is the British mainstream media Islamophobic? Does it promote Islamophobia?
Yes, of course it does. They're promoting Islamophobia in many ways. And the fact that this sort of a story doesn't break out, the fact that, even when it breaks out, nobody is calling for resignation of Gove, which if it was, if the same treatment was dished out to any other community, they would have been called for resignation. And shrinking spaces, sort of 10, 20 years ago, a Muslim community as a whole had a more voice, a very diverse voice in the British media. Now it doesn't. And now it's even sort of Zionists speaking on behalf of the Muslims and everybody else, racist. So I actually agree with what Yvonne is saying. We need to be more confident in ourselves. The last conference, which was in January, on Islamophobia conference, which we held, we looked at how we could work with the establishment. Should we work with them? Yes, no, maybe. And we looked at the historical, and indeed we looked at the experience of the black community, and we looked at it from a theological basis and everything. We need to revive the right of standing up to the bullies, because the bullies are taking over, and the government and the media are part of that bully.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests for the show tonight, Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedburgh, also Head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajadeh, speaking to us from the British capital, London. And also a special thanks to